While we deliver our live broadcast, a special committee in the U.S. House of Representatives is hearing testimony about the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. In our political system at the moment, the major players can't even agree on the motives of the people who attacked the Capitol or the results of the attack. That alone tells you a lot about our country at the moment and the level of division in society. And it's not just two sides, says our guest this hour. George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic, identifies four Americas in his book, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. George Packer has been down this road before with extensive writing about America and its challenges at home and in the world. He has written six other nonfiction books, two novels, one play, and has edited three books of collected essays. George Packer, pleasure to have you on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's nice to be with you. I'm glad to hear it's raining there.
Oh, boy, we are too, so appreciate that. This book is obviously about our time, but it harkens back to others who trod this path before you.
Well, there's what I call near-death experiences scattered throughout American history. I think of 2020 as a near-death experience. And so during the pandemic, when I couldn't travel and couldn't do much reporting, I read and looked into the 1850s and the years leading up to the first and biggest near-death experience, the Civil War, the Great Depression and the New Deal, and the 60s when racial injustice, violence, war all seemed to be driving America towards some kind of cataclysm. And the thing that they all have in common is that the basic fight was over the idea of equality, which I think has been the key contest throughout American history. What does it mean to be equal citizens? And I think that's still true today with the really deep and corrosive divisions that we are living with in 2021.
And even before the Civil War, as you point out in the book, interesting, what did Lincoln say about the destruction of the American experiment way back in 1838?
Yes, he gave a speech as a young Illinois state legislator. He was 28 years old, and he asked the question, how might American democracy die? How might our political institutions perish? And his answer was, there will be no Napoleon crossing the Atlantic and traveling over the Blue Ridge Mountains to drink from the Ohio River. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. We, as a nation of free men, we shall live through all time or die by suicide. That was Lincoln well ahead of the Civil War, saying we are too vigorous and strong to be conquered from without, but we could commit suicide, which in a sense means destroy our system of self-government, which kind of haunted Lincoln's imagination throughout his career.
Yeah, through his life, obviously. So is it just too hard to work together? Are we too different from each other? And if it is too hard, what made it so hard?
I think these crises come about when certain tensions and divisions become so great that Americans see one another as threats, as existential threats. And the identification is no longer over, well, this is my party, or this is my region, or these are my ideas, but this is my life. This is my values, my core values, and you, your ideas, your existence is a threat to them. And we're really very close to that today, I think. We're in what I think of as a cold civil war right now. And there have been times in the past year when it seemed threatening to become a hot one, and I think that could easily happen again. In my view, there's two things that have brought us to this point in the last few decades. One is the rise of what I call a multi-everything democracy, a democracy in which all groups begin to have more of a say, in which immigrants, Black Americans, Brown Americans, women, and other historically disfranchised groups begin to come to the fore and assert their rights as citizens. And this is something that's unprecedented in American history. And so we've become a more inclusive and more diverse country in these decades. At the same time, we've become a more unequal country because the end of the industrial age and the rise of the information economy have divided us dramatically into winners and losers based on education, largely, in a way that we haven't seen since the Gilded Age 120 years ago. So I think of those two trends, the biggest trends of my life, the rise of a multi-everything democracy and the growth of extreme inequality as creating so much competition and suspicion and resentment that we have divided into tribes that regard one another with a lot of suspicion and hostility.
It's interesting when I think what you're talking about is potentially us agreeing on some basic sets of facts, but completely disagreeing on whether it's good or awful for the country. I mean, if we're a multi-everything country, then there's no single group in charge, which obviously the group that was in charge doesn't think is a good idea at all, while all the other ones do.
Right. And if you think of the group that was in charge, which essentially was white America, and white male America, that rise of other groups plus the decline of the economic life that sustained working class America, industrial America, in the small towns and the industrial cities, in the rural areas. All you have to do is drive a few dozen miles outside any prosperous metropolitan area in this country, and you begin to encounter something close to ghost towns, hollowed out main streets, where the life of the community really has withered away because of economic transformation from industrial to information. And that is so universal now that it is, I think, you know, a constant pressure of division. And so, yeah, we may agree that these things are happening, but not whether they're good or not. And that's actually led to disagreement over basic facts. Do vaccinations work? Who won the election of 2020? Was January 6th an insurrection or patriots reclaiming democracy? Is global warming real or is it a hoax? I mean, these are basic things that we no longer can even come to a settled agreement about. Here are the facts. We disagree about what to do about them, but let's at least start with a shared reality. We no longer have a shared reality.
We'll talk about steps to get there as we continue with George Packer, the author of Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening to the JX. Our guest is George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic and prolific author otherwise, writing once again about the situation in which America finds itself, where we can't agree on a lot of things, including some basic facts. George Packer's latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. We'll talk about four different kinds of America that he identifies and the areas where they overlap and potentially show some hope for reconciliation. You can join in the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 on the phone or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. George, you make comparisons between the United States in the year 2020 and France in 1940, just prior to Germany coming in and knocking it over. What parallels do you see?
Well, there's a wonderful book called Strange Defeat by a French historian who became a resistance fighter and was executed by the Nazis, Marc Bloch. And in it, he describes how France was shocked at its own collapse before the German invasion. But he looked at the previous decade or two and saw how national identity and solidarity, how cultural strength, how all the things that hold the nation together had been deteriorating, had been atrophying, so that France was almost just ready to be pushed aside when the moment of the German invasion came. And I think of 2020 as a kind of strange defeat, when for all of our prowess with advanced medicine, all of our wealth, all of our hospital capacity, we became the world's worst COVID case. It was shocking to Americans to discover that we led the world and still lead the world, disproportionate to our population, in COVID deaths. And why was that? Because COVID exploited all sorts of underlying conditions in American society. At the start, terrible leadership, a cynical and incompetent government led by President Trump, which essentially washed its hands of responsibility and left it to the states and to individuals. And then it began to use the pandemic to divide us in order to improve Trump's reelection prospects. But there were also the economic inequalities of working class Americans who had to go to work and in perilous conditions, risking their lives for the rest of us who got to sit at home in front of laptops. That division became a source of real, I think, resentment, and justifiably so. Black and white Americans experienced it very differently in terms of rates of sickness and death, regions, and politically. It divided us into the masked and the unmasked, into those who took the pandemic as something that should be answered with science and those who listened to Trump and said, we're not going to follow the experts. All these divisions left us, I think, almost naked and helpless in front of this disaster. And it showed how really unready we are, how unable to govern ourselves collectively together in the face of a crisis. You need national solidarity and something coming from the center, from the government, to lead you out of it. And we didn't have that. And that was, to me, a little reminiscent of a great nation like France suddenly finding itself defeated almost overnight.
Did you take heart, at least in the beginning of the pandemic in America, about things like the mass making of masks by people at home with their sewing machines, cheers for health workers? I mean, it did seem, at least at moments, like we were turning to each other.
I did, and I still am moved by the level of volunteerism and generosity and sacrifice that so many Americans made. And I don't want to omit those because they were real, but they were really coming up from the grassroots. They were not organized by the government or by any institution that has the power and the ability to solve a problem on this scale. Americans are in many ways a good-hearted people who take care of their neighbors. But very quickly, the pandemic went from being something that could have brought us together, because, of course, it hits every human being, to something that divided us. That happened like in a period of about 2 or 3 weeks in March and April. And for the rest of the year, I think it was more a source of division. And here we see it again in the question of whether to require vaccination mandates, to have vaccine passports, and why some Americans refuse to get vaccinated. And that is simply because we're divided. And if Joe Biden says, we want you to be vaccinated, and Anthony Fauci says it, then some Americans are going to say, the hell with you, I'm not going to do it.
George Packer's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. George, if you would, tell the story that you include in the book of the nurse in El Paso who was at the end of her rope and talked to a COVID patient who had recovered.
Yeah, this was something I read on Twitter by a nurse named Ashley Bartholomew, who had been working for about 10 years and had been so overwhelmed by the number of cases of sickness and death she saw in a 2-week period with, you know, not enough refrigerated morgue trucks. It was just a disaster. This was like in late summer, that she was ready to quit. And on her last shift, she met a man who was recovering from COVID and who still didn't believe it was serious, even though he was in the ICU, surrounded by people who were sick and dying. And he told her he didn't believe it was serious. And she dropped her nurse's demeanor and began to cry and told him what she was seeing every day, and had that she had given CPR to more people in a week than in 10 years. And then she wheeled him out to the lower level of care. And on his way out, he saw these people who were breathing their last breaths. And that's what it took to convince this man, who himself had COVID, that it was serious. And so it shows, yes, personal experience can change you, but that's an extreme level of personal experience it should take in order to believe in something that is being reported everywhere as a disaster. And I think for this nurse, it was both a moment of kindness and connection to this man, but also of kind of despair. Like, why should it take this much to convince people that it's real and that we owe it to ourselves and one another to take all the precautions we can, including wearing a mask, which should not be a political act, but which has become a political act.
Well, let's talk about that part of it then, because as you point out in the book, the idea of saying I need to be free from a mask differs greatly from the way people like Alexis de Tocqueville defined freedom.
You know, freedom today basically means let me live my life as I want. Stay out of my business. Stay off my property. Don't tell me to wear a mask. It's a negative freedom. Freedom from obstructions and from the government. Freedom in the 19th century to Tocqueville, who wrote Democracy in America in the 1830s, meant free institutions. It meant positive freedom, participating together in self-government, which is hard, which is not natural, and which really is the opposite of saying, leave me alone. It's more like saying we have to come together face-to-face in order to solve problems through the free institutions that we have in this country. So I think of freedom then as a more, I don't know, a more mature and optimistic thing and less dark and pessimistic than the freedom that we have today, which is connected to the four Americas that you mentioned, those four narratives that I think have really defined us in the last few decades.
Which I do want to get to in a few minutes here, a couple more things to talk about here, including the fact that we had protests against the lockdowns, and then, of course, we had protests against police brutality after George Floyd's murder at the end of May 2020. Can you draw some parallels with those or make some distinctions between them?
Well, obviously, they were coming from completely different parts of our society. The anti-lockdown protests were mostly people in the heartland, people in rural areas and small towns, mostly white, mostly middle-aged. And those were part of what I was describing a minute ago is insisting on negative freedom. You know, your constitutional rights don't, your fear shouldn't trump my constitutional rights. That's a sign I saw in the coverage of one of these anti-lockdown protests. So my freedom is the freedom not to wear a mask, not to lock down, and even to get you sick, because you can't tell me that I have to change my life just because you're afraid. And it also meant I have a livelihood I want to sustain, and you're getting in the way of that. In fact, you're risking it. The George Floyd protests were about social justice. They were mostly younger people of all races, mostly in the cities, although in a lot of towns as well. They were not directly related to the pandemic. They were a kind of eruption in the middle of it that was connected more to things that had been happening for a while before the pandemic, police brutality and the viral videos that had shocked the conscience of many Americans. What the two have in common, I think, is a deep suspicion of the state and of its power, and a sense that the state is unaccountable and is using its power to deny people's rights and won't listen, that the state and the institutions of democracy are no longer able to respond to what the citizens want. And so protests become sort of the last act you can commit nonviolently when you don't feel heard by your government. And so in a sense, I think they, even though they were diametrically opposed politically and demographically, they both reflected the failure of our institutions of democracy to answer people's cries and to make their lives better.
George Packer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a staff writer at The Atlantic and a prolific author otherwise, has written before about America and its challenges at home and in the world. His latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. This might push a couple of buttons, and you want to push some buttons to talk to us. It's 800-838-3760 to join in the conversation by phone, or send your thoughts by email to jx@jeffnet.org. Before we get to the four Americas, you offer essentially eight narratives and ultimately boil it down to your own single sentence. What would those come down to?
Well, I offer eight explanations for how we got to 2020, basically. 2020 being sort of the height of crisis that had been building for a long time, and which then had not just the pandemic and not just the protests, but also an impeachment, the grounds for a second impeachment, an election, a highly contested election, and then the threat of violence and the threat of even overthrowing election results, overthrowing democracy itself. So it was a big year. And not to mention, as you know, Jeff, wildfires, storms, every reminder that global warming has borne down on us is here. So it felt like every day some new cataclysm was going to come. I was in a state of dread. That was the state in which I began writing this book in the fall of 2020. So I have eight accounts of how we got to this point. I won't go through each of them, but they each take a view of how did Americans become so divided, and how can we become a country again? We all know we're red and blue. That's obvious. Every election proves it. But within red and blue, there are further divisions. On the red side, what I call free America and real America. And on the blue side, what I call smart America and just America. And so if we have time, I can describe for listeners what each of those refers to.
Absolutely. One minor aside here, which is you take us back before you get into this conversation about to 1968, where we had the Vietnam War, riots, Nixon getting elected. One of the things that really strikes me, though, when we get back to one of the central causes of all this is inequality, and particularly struck since 1968 by the dilution of worker power since that time. And with many taxes cut, the dilution of the effectiveness of government, too. Do you see those working in this vein?
Profoundly, profoundly. I think what we've seen in the last 40, 50 years is the transfer of wealth and power from essentially a middle-class democracy. Of course, we had rich people in the 60s, but taxes, regulations, the structure of the economy, and just self-restraint, decency, shame, kept inequality from becoming too extreme. And now we're in the age of robber barons. You know, they go into space every week or two. And meanwhile, we're in the age of a service economy, a service class that can barely survive from week to week while working. And that is the fundamental economic reality that we have come to live with. And it persists regardless of whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in power, whether it's a boom or a recession, whether we're at war or at peace. That's the fundamental fact of the last 50 years is this inequality. I go back to 68 because I have this image of the conventions of that year described by Norman Mailer in his great book, Miami and the Siege of Chicago. And basically you have two narratives that are pretty clear. What I call the fair shake, that's the Democratic narrative. It's on the side of working people wanting to get a fair shake, a fair deal, and getting ahead. That's the Republican narrative. Small businessmen, self-employed people, entrepreneurs, and people in small corporations who see, you know, the purpose of government is to help the enterprising get ahead. And those are the two narratives that persisted for most of the 20th century. They began to break down in the 70s when a lot of things started to change. And now, after several decades, I think they've turned into four. And they're mutually antagonistic and in some ways, quite hostile. So I think of Free America as the first. It arose with Reagan. It was the most powerful of the four. It dominated politics for most of our adult lives. It said, get government out of my life, lower my taxes, set me free, and I will be able to live out my dream and we'll have general prosperity. And that was the shining city on a hill that Reagan described. And he made it sound very attractive, but in practice it turned out to create vast divisions of wealth and poverty. And it kind of ended the union blue-collar America that had been the backbone of the fair shake. And instead, it led to plutocrats and struggling working people who had to hold down two or three jobs, and it had no answer for the inequality that globalization and technology produced. So that's Free America, a kind of beautiful idea that I think has created a tremendous amount of hardship around the country. It remained the orthodoxy of the Republican Party. Up till today, you still hear Republicans in Congress saying, cut taxes and we'll solve our problems. We'll have more jobs. The data prove otherwise, but the orthodoxy, like all ideologies, has remained hard and unchanging in spite of the facts.
And as you point out, this is a rather libertarian point of view, and you say libertarians leave out society. Do they just not believe at the core that we do things together?
Do you remember Margaret Thatcher, who was the British version of Free America, once said there's no such thing as society, there's only individuals. And I think, in a sense, Reagan believed that too. I mean, he talked in his early, when he was running for president in 1980, he talked about national renewal and great collective efforts. But in practice, it was really a kind of country of individuals. We became taxpayers, entrepreneurs, employers, employees, everything except citizens. Citizenship was the category that disappeared. And that is because I think the idea behind Free America, was a libertarian idea, which saw the role of government as to be as unobtrusive as possible, really just to provide for safety and a minimum of public works, and to let the market do its magic. It's a kind of market fundamentalist idea.
All right. Free America, followed by Smart America, Real America, Just America. Back with George Packer and Last Best Hope on the Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is George Packer, staff writer at The Atlantic and a prolific author otherwise, often looking at the issues in America today, which are considerable. We just can't get a lot of things done because we can't agree on some basic facts, as we have proven through the COVID pandemic. George Packer's latest book is Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. It's a conversation you're welcome to join as we talk about the four Americas George sees and the ways in which they overlap and don't. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So again, Free America, Smart America, Real America, Just America. We just talked about Free America. Smart America, this is like Silicon Valley smart, George? George?
Clinton's America.
There we go.
So there's a sort of, can you hear me?
We got you, yeah.
Yeah. There's a kind of chronology here from Reagan to Clinton. The 90s was the rise of the educated professionals in the information economy who were the real winners of the economic transformation. Bill Clinton hailed the internet as the greatest engine for human freedom and prosperity. And the answer to every problem was get a college degree and you will end up on the winning side of the line. It's essentially meritocracy, the idea that you should be rewarded for your talents, your brain power, by a society that the higher salaries, the better jobs, the better lives go to those people. The problem with Smart America is it's become itself a kind of privileged class, almost an aristocracy of the educated, because it's harder and harder to get into it. And once you're in, parents make sure their children don't fall out. They give them test prep tutors, and they work on their college application essays, and staying in the educated class and going to the right schools and getting the right credentials becomes a huge part of the effort and energy of these families. So it's a kind of new aristocracy that no longer, to me, is a true meritocracy, because it isn't based so much on talent as it is on the luck of birth, and it has bred a lot of resentment among the people on the other side who were those without college degrees.
So this answers, I think, in part a question that I have sort of running through the entire narrative, which is how it is that somebody who has never been without money in his life, Donald Trump, managed to convince a bunch of Americans that he was on their side and against the rich people like him, and somehow he managed to dodge the bullets that logically should have gone his way. I'll take exception to my own use of the term bullets, but you get the idea.
I get it. I think the answer is Trump fed the resentments of people without money, without educations, who are not the winners in our economy. And they looked at him not as a member of that privileged class, but as a tribune of the people who perhaps he had gotten rich on his own talents. That was the narrative. But the others, those experts, those elites, are simply there to tell you what you can and can't do and say. And that resentment became the source of his political power. And that is what I call real America, which is a phrase Sarah Palin originally used in the 2008 campaign. And she was referring basically to the white Christian heartland towns, rural areas, where she said, you know, they fight our wars and make our food and teach our children and work hard. The only problem is those areas had become hollowed out and depressed by 2008. They were no longer optimistic places. And Trump saw the pessimism and played into it by telling them, I know who is causing your problems. It's those elites on the coasts and in the cities, those condescending, smug, educated people, and it's the foreigners who are coming in and taking your jobs. And that was a powerful line of talk that is a kind of natural, it's demagogic, and demagogues are natural products of democracy, because the people in democracy think they should rule. And when they're being told that it's actually these elites who are ruling over them, it's easy to take them down the path of resentment and nativism and very ugly things. And that's how Trump, I think, secured power in real America.
Well, you also take up in this portion of the book, though, about the concept of Trump as fascist, and you say it lets the rest of society off the hook. How is that?
I mean, there is a kind of question of how to define Trump. And some scholars and journalists have said he's like a fascist. He's like the authoritarians of the early 20th century. And I just think it doesn't describe Trump or his people. Fascism was like a really energetic, forward-looking way of organizing society around great national projects like war and collectivization and genocide. And it took something for a leader to convince people to throw themselves at his feet and sacrifice and work themselves to the bone in order to create this great national project. I don't see that in Trump. His rallies don't look like fascist rallies. The faces of his followers are in a kind of happy snarl you might see from people watching an episode of Jersey Shore. And they go home before the speech is even over because there's no inspiration from Trump. It's just negative. That doesn't mean he isn't authoritarian and isn't a threat to democracy. He is. But I think of him much more as an all-American figure, a demagogue, the kind we know from our history, the kind we know from Mark Twain and Citizen Kane and All the King's Men. This is an all-American thing. It is not an import from Europe. It's something we should be familiar with.
So Free America, Smart America, we just talked about Real America. That takes us to Just America. And you say a more accurate name would be Unjust America. These are the people in society who think we can do a lot better than we've done.
Right. And this was the narrative that drove people into the streets last spring and summer after the murder of George Floyd. It's a generational narrative, a shift from my generation, which is late boomers and Gen X, to the millennials and Gen Z. It's a kind of rebellion against what I think are perceived as the hollow promises of the parents, that we're making progress as a country, that we're becoming a more just country. As Barack Obama loved to say, we're becoming a more perfect union. We're not perfect, but we're becoming more perfect. And that idea of gradual but inevitable progress was belied by wars, by the financial crisis and the recession, by the images of police brutality, by the fact of injustice towards so many Black Americans. And so I think this new generation, a bit like the boomers of the 60s, threw off the assurances of their parents and said, no, not only are we not making progress, we're fixed as a kind of caste society. Not much has changed in 200 or more years, which is why there's so much interest now in the history of slavery and segregation. And so what we need to do is have a radical transformation of our society, because gradual reform is not going to do it. And so it's a bit like Real America. It's a pessimistic and resentful narrative that doesn't buy the sunny optimism of either the Free America or Smart America, which came earlier and came more from elites.
Let's take a phone call here. Pam and Dexter, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with George Packer, the author of Last Best Hope.
Hi. Well, I've been thinking about these things a lot lately, as I'm sure many people are. And one of the things I think that makes this time different than any other in history of our country is that we have the internet. So there's all this information out there, and it's hard for many people to, or maybe it's not hard, but they're lazy. They don't really look for the basis of these statements and facts and the science that backs it up, et cetera. So there's all this information out there, and people kind of pick and choose what they want to believe. And then we have this climate emergency where, for instance, our well is running dry where I live in Dexter, Oregon. And so we're having climate refugees. People all over the world are dealing with the scarcity, food shortages, et cetera. And even if you don't believe consciously in the climate emergency, I believe everybody subconsciously knows it's happening. So there's this circling of the wagons, us against them. We don't want those people coming into our country and using our resources. And so I've been hoping for the great healing where we unite and heal the planet and each other and work through this climate emergency. But I think Trump was so divisive, and there's something about him that's very primeval, that the amphibian kind of brain where it's us against them. And I'm very concerned that it's the beginning of the great unraveling of our civilization. And I really hope people start to sit up and take into account where we're at in this time in history, because it really is, we have a choice of survival and thriving or really a great unraveling. And I'm just wondering what you think about that. And I'll listen on the radio. And thanks for the show.
All right. Thanks, Pam. Thanks for calling.
Oh, those are some amazing points. The great unraveling, I mean, I wrote a book called The Unwinding a few years ago that's exactly about this, about the dissolution of our democracy and the amphibian brain. Yes, he has this reptilian genius. He intuits what people want to hear and gives it to them brilliantly. He's a great propagandist, Trump. And I think you're right that our divisions are bringing us close to self-destruction, especially with climate. It's interesting that COVID seems capable of changing people's minds. I'm reading even this week about cases of Americans who refused the vaccine because they thought it was unhealthy or unsafe, and then they got sick and ended up in the ICU and changed their mind. Can climate do the same thing? If your well is running dry, if southeastern Oregon is being destroyed by wildfires, can that, if it's literally right in your property, can it change the way you think about it? I think the only way that can happen is not through rational debate. I used to believe more in that, but I think people just resist when they're being told, look at the facts. And instead, I think if there is something like local face-to-face cooperation, not to prove that you're right and I'm wrong, but to solve a problem like drought and the effects of drought or the effects of wildfire, I think it could, pardon the pun, lower the temperature. And I also think if, and this is where the book lands, if we get closer to the fifth narrative that we haven't talked about, but what I call equal America, where we see one another as equal citizens with equal opportunities and rights. And that's something that involves a lot of government intervention. It involves raising the dignity of work through legislation. It involves helping people who are struggling. It involves empowering labor and breaking up monopolies. If those things begin to happen as they are under Biden, I think that too can lower the temperature. It won't change people's minds, but at least they will see government improving their lives in the lower half of the economy. And that will perhaps take some of the poison out of our politics, which has been with us for so long. That's my hope, and that's where the book takes us, because I don't leave with despair. I want to leave with something like a positive vision. But I think it's the odds are getting longer and longer.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We have about 2 minutes left, George. I just want to ask about a point in the epilogue about how we have to place more faith in ourselves and one another than we can bear. I mean, there is a level of not just that I don't trust you, but I don't trust me. So let's elect somebody who could just do this stuff for us. And that's the scary part, isn't it? The giving up.
Exactly. Absolutely. That's a perennial problem for self-government. It's hard work. At times it's too hard. It asks more of us than most of us really can give or want to give. And at times it seems easier just to say, let science tell us, or let the demagogue rule us, or let an algorithm figure it out, or let this privileged class of the educated rule us because they know more than we do. All of those are escapes from democracy. Because democracy demands that all of us do it as self-governing citizens. And I think there are ways we can come back to that, but I think that is the answer, to restore the role of the citizen in making decisions and in working with other people who don't look like you or sound like you or think like you. Because right now, in our bubbles, which are all reinforced by social media and the internet, we're turning into warring tribes.
Yeah, a whole lot of distrust, but that whole idea, and it's interesting too, because it reminds me of a caller from many years ago who said, we need a council of elders or something. In other words, somebody else who could do this because we can't. And so that's a major point that resonates as we come to the end of Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal, the latest book by George Packer. George, thank you so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.